Our fourth case for this morning is Edwards Brown against Crete Moniel 201 School District, 201U School District. Mr. Johnson?
Gavin Johnson on behalf of Angela Brown. I think it's still morning.
Oh, for a while, yeah.
This case presents the issue of whether or not a district court has a responsibility once it decides to appoint counsel for a pro se plaintiff, whether or not they should engage the Pruitt analysis as set forth by the court. Let's just say that Angela Brown approached the court after her son was killed on his father's property after a school district released her son when they, of course, should not have. The judge below denied Brown's first request for appointed counsel, which was made at the time she filed the complaint, her first appearance. The judge denied her request for counsel on the grounds that she had served the defendants and had filed the complaint, and therefore, presumably, he felt that she was not entitled to counsel. We don't know, and that's one of the interesting...
That important. He eventually appoints two different lawyers. So she hasn't suffered any detriment at the initial denial, and I don't know whether she was asking still for a lawyer after the second one was relieved from the case.
Well, she did, Judge, and the judge said, I believe on the February 24th, he said, I don't think you need counsel. I don't think you need counsel, so I don't even remember why. I don't even remember your efforts to obtain counsel.
Which is a factor under Pruitt against Moat.
It is a factor, Judge, but the appellant actually listed the number of attorneys she had tried to obtain prior to.
She did this after the second counsel withdrew?
Sorry?
She did this after the second counsel withdrew?
No, this is initially, Judge. This is initially. So we have a situation where if the court would allow a metaphor, the purpose of counsel, assistance of counsel to a pro se plaintiff or any plaintiff, is to carry water in a bucket. In this situation, the bucket was full of holes, so it really did not achieve the purpose for which it was intended. We can't dispute that Pruitt applies. We know from looking at the record that the case was complicated. It was in 1983 where she's trying to sue a police, a city, and a school district. The appellees...
Counsel, if I could interrupt for a minute, in what sense is this issue even properly before us? All we have, as I understand the case, is the district court's denial as untimely the Rule 60B motion. And that's what the appeal is limited to. We don't have plenary review here of what happened in the district court.
Well, I don't see how it's not related, since it's precisely because the court denied her 60B that she didn't have counsel. I mean, it's interrelated in the sense that Brown circumstances filed a reinstatement after she had voluntarily dismissed. The voluntary dismissal was under Rule 41, which was effective at the date it was filed. So when she subsequently files a reinstatement, the court ruled it was a nullity, and he denied it. But had she had counsel, none of this would have occurred, which is the point.
But what normally happens in civil cases, first of all, the district court has Rule 60B to deal with, and it has a one-year limitation on motions of the sort that she was bringing, mistake, inadvertence, et cetera. It's really a mistake case. And it's barred, and you can't move to 60B6 if 60B1 covers things. And as far as the idea of reinstating the case under something like the Illinois statute, that too has the same 1 year. Now, when people are caught in that, it may seem harsh, but these rules apply to pro se people just as they apply to counseled people.
I understand it, Your Honor, but the point is, had Brown had counsel, which she should have been entitled to, had the court undergone the Pruitt analysis, then she would not have been in that situation. And in that sense, she was prejudiced. Sorry?
I mean, it strikes me as very speculative, and I'm not sure, again, that the court wasn't proceeding as Pruitt suggested. The court appoints a couple of lawyers. They withdraw. The court says, are you still looking? She doesn't come back. She's in a very difficult position. We understand that. But she doesn't come back and explain to the judge, you know, I really still need counsel.
It's my understanding she did.
I don't see that in the record. But, you know, it's even if she did and the judge didn't appoint it, it's really a chain too far, it seems to me, to say that the judge abuses his discretion by enforcing a clear federal rule of civil procedure. You have to file this motion within a year. It doesn't say within a year and 6 days. It says within a year.
But I believe that the court rules allow for excusable neglect, and contrary to what the
year limit, though.
But contrary to what the appellee has indicated, Ms. Brown did raise the fact that she was misled by the court officer into filing the motion that she did, voluntary.
How did she do that?
Sorry?
How did she notify the district court that she was told she had a year from the date of the order?
Docket entry 103. Docket entry 103 states that Angela Brown, she filed the voluntary dismissal after her mother died. She was just, she couldn't do any more. So she files this voluntary dismissal, and the court deputy, I believe it was, Mr. Rouse, tells her that this is not the right way to do it. What you need to do is...
I understand you say that happened, but how did Ms. Brown let the district court know that that was the advice?
Well, she put that in the pleading in docket entry 103, Judge.
Is that one of her 60B motions?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, the part of 60 of Rule 60 on timing uses mandatory language. The 60B1 motion must be filed within 1 year, and that doesn't make it sound like it's waivable.
Well, I think this court has indicated before that when a party is misled by if a party is misled, then we tend to look at that as excusable neglect.
But again, that's the ground of 60B1. You're talking about excusable neglect on top of excusable neglect. And I'm concerned that the rules, in the interest of finding some finality to these things, the rules have established a fairly generous one-year period of time. And very unfortunately for Ms. Brown, she didn't make it.
But I think that when you have a pro se plaintiff, I think it is imperative to us to examine the why that was not made. And if it was excusable neglect, if in fact it was excusable neglect, then the judge was wrong in denying her motion.
Okay. Well, if you'd like to save a minute or two for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Julie Kerner on behalf of the school district. I'm actually sharing my time this morning before the panel with counsel for the Village of Crete, so I am going to be addressing the very straightforward issue on the propriety of the Judge Canelli's rulings on the 41A1 dismissal and the denial of 60B. He's actually going to be dealing with the issues of tolling and with the issues with respect to counsel, although, as Judge Sykes did point out this morning, that the issue of counsel really is not before this court, and that the court is really limited to the issues that I'm here to talk about. But either way, as Your Honor points out, Judge Wood, I mean, the court, Judge Canelli, did properly apply the standard under 41A1A little I. The order when plaintiff filed that voluntarily dismissing her action was self-executing. It did not require any further action by the court and therefore did become effective arguably on October 26th, but even giving her the second time frame, that's 11-10. This case is directly on all fours with the Jenkins versus Maywood case, which Judge Sykes...
I have a question for you, which is whether there was any discretion in the district court to relax the one-year requirement. Clearly what the court is doing is it's taking that Rule 41 dismissal as the starting point of the one-year period. As you say, there are two possible dates, but they actually don't really matter for what we're doing. But is there any doctrine that would allow the court to deviate from that, to say, well, in your case, you didn't make the 1 year. Maybe that's what your colleague is going to talk about, but that's what interests me.
I don't believe that there is any provision for relaxing it. And even if there had been, I think that Judge Canelli actually erred on the side of whether or not there might be some leeway, because he actually did look at her 60B motion. Besides saying it was untimely, he also decided that it was not appropriate and it was that she did not have an insufficient basis under 60B to bring forth or to refile her action. So I would argue that there isn't a basis to extend it, that it's mandatory and jurisdictional, and that there is no, with the federal rules of appellate procedure, obviously there is that one extension of 14 days that the court can give on filing a notice of appeal. There is that is worked into the actual rules, but there is no provision for the court to relax this for any period of time that is put forth in the federal rules of civil procedure.
Don't we, in fact, have several cases that so hold, that the one-year time limit is mandatory and jurisdictional? Arrieta versus Battaglia, Wesco Products versus Alloy Automotive.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, your question was the older cases?
We've already held that that one-year time limit is mandatory and jurisdictional. There's no discretion. The court has no authority to extend it. There are no overriding equitable doctrines that apply. It's hard and fast. Too bad, so sad.
Yes.
And if that's the case, then Bowles against Russell says it's also a shame if she received bad advice from the clerk, but there's nothing anyone can do about it.
Correct.
I want to ask you about that bad advice. You say in your brief that that was not brought to the district court's attention. On page 31 of your brief, Mr. Johnson seems to dispute that. Who's right?
It's my recollection, based on the review of the record, that she never brought it to the attention of the court that she had had any conversation with Olga Rouse.
He refers to, I guess it's his reply brief, document 103.
Plaintiff filed three or four subsequent motions under Rule 60B, asking the court continuously to take a look at different issues and raising everything, even after she filed the notice of appeal. At no point in time did she file any affidavit saying that she had that discussion with the court deputy. And even if she did, plaintiffs and parties cannot rely on directions from court staff. I mean, she wasn't misled by the defendants in terms of what time she could file. She had an obligation to check the rules on her own. And to sit there and argue that Ms. Brown was an unsavvy plaintiff is really inaccurate, as the court probably noticed. She had brought two prior federal litigations that she had been involved in. One was herself she filed. and one she other and the other one she had counsel on that. So to say that she is unsavvy in, as counsel represented, isn't really accurate. She filed every single complaint on her own. She followed the court's directions and followed, after she reviewed motions by the defendants to dismiss. She amended her pleadings in line with those motions to dismiss and in line with the court's sort of directions to her. So she was not an unsavvy plaintiff. And the court took that into consideration when it didn't. And she never asked for the third attorney. She only asked for the two. That's also, I believe, a misrepresentation by plaintiff's counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Connor.
Good morning. May it please the court. As Ms. Kerner indicated, my name is Patrick O'Connor. I'm representing Crete. And although our positions, at least with respect to these issues, are pretty aligned, we did divide up the arguments that we were going to make. So it was my recollection, based upon the review of the record, and is why we put it in the brief, that after Mr. Bruck, the second attorney appointed by Judge Cannelli to represent Ms. Brown, withdrew, what the judge said is that, and this is in document 127, he says, I've forgotten what efforts you made to try to find a lawyer on your own. I don't want to go through that now, but you need to keep working on that. And so after that occurred in August of 2008, what happened after that is Ms. Brown filed an amended complaint. Both of the defendants moved to dismiss that complaint. And about a month after that, in October, Ms. Brown filed her first motion to voluntarily dismiss the case. And since neither one of us had filed an answer or a motion for summary judgment, at that point, upon filing at the earliest on October 26th, that affected the immediate dismissal of the complaint, and her 1 year started running. What Judge Cannelli did is gave her the benefit of the doubt because she did file an amended motion. It was substantially the same. But what she indicated in document 103, which was alluded to, I believe, and I don't have the R-103 right in front of me, was that Olga Rouse told her she had to file a more legible copy of the motion. Evidently, the first October 26 motion was not that legible, so she noticed up a motion and filed a motion on November 10th, which was set for a hearing on November 17th. But even taking that later November 10th date, as Judge Cannelli did, she still, when she filed her motion to what's called reinstate the case on November 16th of the following year, the judge said it was 6 days late. It was actually, in my view, at least it was at least 6 days late. It was probably actually much more. But after the second attorney withdrew, Ms. Brown did never filed another motion asking the court to appoint another counsel. And to say that that would have made a difference in the outcome is speculative. In fact, in both Jenkins and Nelson versus Napolitano, the two cases that are very similar to this one, both of those plaintiff's attorneys were represented by attorneys. And they made a similar error in calculating the time for refiling. And so I'm aware of no case and no rule in which a district court can relax those standards because the plaintiff is a pro se litigant. So to say that none of this would have occurred, which is how opposing counsel indicates that this issue on the appointment of counsel is relevant, in my view, it's not. I think we say in our brief that the only issue that is presented by this court is whether the court properly or whether the court abuses discretion in denying the motion to reinstate. Actually,
I was going to ask you whether you thought that was an abuse of discretion standard or whether you think it's sufficiently compelled by law that it's really just a legal issue.
Well, I
believe like there's some discretion to abuse, and that's what I am interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I believe what I put down is that I think the case law supports it talks about the denial of that is an abuse of discretion, that's how it's reviewed. But I think what they're talking about is the calculation of the time. Reasonable time is discussed in 60B6 or something, I think, talks about reasonable time, whereas those under 60B1, 2, and 3 talk about a 1 year. It doesn't provide anything with regard to the discretion there. But I think
when
if
there's a statutory standard to apply, like a reasonable time or the excusable neglect substantive standard of 60B1, then there is some discretion to abuse. When the judge is making a time calculation decision, there isn't any discretion, and particularly here where it's a jurisdictional limit, it either is timely or it's untimely as a matter of law.
I would agree.
None of the merits of these alternative arguments are properly before the court. We're just deciding whether the timeliness decision.
Well, right. I mean, what I argued was that the 60B, 60B1, 2, or 3, which talks about, and that's really the only one that Ms. Brown would fit into, is a 60B1, and that contains a 1 year. I mean, she states repeatedly it was a mistake.
Okay, your time is up, but thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Johnson?
In our view, the appellee says on the one hand, Mrs. Brown had a meritless case, and on the other hand, that the case was very simplistic and she was savvy. It's our view that the record itself demonstrates that neither was true. Number one, it was a complex case, and therefore the judge, once he decided to appoint, had to undergo the Pruitt analysis, and had he done so, plaintiff would have gotten out of the box on this matter. Her litigation was torpedoed from the very beginning when the judge said, hey, you sued the wrong parties, let me show you how to do this. 3 days later, she did exactly what the judge did, but she didn't take the time to calculate exactly what was involved in making the amendment. We see a number of mistakes throughout this that demonstrates that Ms. Brown was not competent to litigate it, and had the Pruitt analysis been undertaken, none of this would have occurred. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement.